It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the United States is seeing a record rise in rates of homelessness. We'll look at some of the big picture causes and solutions for homelessness in communities around the country. First, the company Signet Jewelers, which owns K Jewelers and Zales, told investors earlier this summer that sales of engagement rings had been down so far this year. Company executives said that part of it's economic, with higher inflation stopping would-be couples from purchasing expensive jewelry, and they say part of it's a ripple effect from the early days of the pandemic, when many single people weren't going on dates and meeting the partners they could eventually propose to. That's one company's view, not a detailed scientific study, but our relationship milestones often come with significant price tags that can bring economic realities into our love lives. We're listening back to a conversation about the financial costs associated with love and romantic relationships at every stage. You can join in by emailing ideas@wpr.org. What role have finances played in your relationships and key decisions? Have you delayed getting married or having kids or other milestones because of the costs? Have you found creative ways to save money in dating or marriage? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Halpern-Meekin is the Vaughn Bascom Professor of Women, Family, and Community and a Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's also faculty at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. I talked with her about this last month. Here's a listen. Big picture, I think we like to think that love conquers all, but what effect, how big an effect do economic conditions and our personal finances have on these relationship milestones?
Yeah, this certainly couldn't be a less romantic topic, right? Good thing it's not Valentine's Day. But this is actually a topic that we spend a lot of time thinking about the role of individual finances and the role of larger economic circumstances in society and what role those play in the relationship decisions people make and the stresses that relationships experience. And by and large, we find that there's an association between these things across lots of different aspects of relationships, the partners we choose, whether or not we get married, whether or not our relationship is under stress, when and how we have children. So there's so many aspects to your question where we really do see connections between finances and relationships.
Something that's come up on conversations on the show here over the last few years is this idea of a marriage gap, or at least a long-term commitment gap, where people with college educations, higher salaries, more likely to find that long-term partner, people at lower socioeconomic levels getting less likely. Is that something you've seen?
Yeah, so we know that about two-thirds of people who have graduated college end up getting married, and that's compared to only about a quarter of people who stop schooling before graduating high school. So kind of looking at those ends of the, you know, educational credential spectrum, we see really big differences in marriage behavior. It's important that we don't equate that with finding a long-term partner, because one of the other trends that we've seen, especially over the last 40 years or so, are really big growth in what we call cohabitation, so living together outside of marriage. So people can find those long-term partnerships. Whether those last and whether they turn into marriage, though, can be a different question, and one that we do see a really big gap on based on education.
Now, we heard the jewelry company there blaming COVID in part on postponing relationship milestones, the dating, the engagement, the marriage for people. When you look back at the last few years over COVID, what impact do you see it having on our decisions to date and get married and things like that?
So I'd say, you know, what the company is claiming is not, it's not totally wrong. It's not totally the whole story. When there's a lot going on in the world, like financial turmoil of a recession or a pandemic, couples are more likely to delay making changes to their relationships. And that includes putting off marriage. It also includes delaying divorce. So during the early years of the pandemic, we saw about a 10% decline in marriage rates and divorce rates. So people sort of stomp the brakes, basically, when something big is going on and put off making those big decisions. That said, we also know that we've seen a long-term trend, not just during the pandemic, in people waiting to later ages to get married and a smaller proportion of the population being married. So we're seeing people being older and older when they do finally get married.
Do we have any idea what's driving that, either people not getting married or getting married later?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of factors that come together, and some of it does have to do with this starting premise, right, that we talked about it being really expensive to buy that engagement ring or have that wedding. So we do have these cultural ideas about what getting engaged or getting married should look like. And those have changed a lot over time. They've really ratcheted up. So we have this idea, I think, in our culture today that a big white fancy wedding dress and a large bridal party and a big reception, those are traditional things. And that's what a wedding should look like. So you have to have enough money to do those things. But that actually didn't become common until the last 50 years or so. Before that, people often had small weddings, sometimes just in their parents' living rooms. So as some of our cultural standards for what, you know, marriage should look like, what a wedding should look like, as those things ramp up, people often feel like they need to wait longer and longer in order to get married. So that's part of what's going on. The other thing I'd say is we have these changing views about what marriage represents. So Andrew Cherlin, who's a really well-known family sociologist, he talks about how marriage used to be seen as the cornerstone of adult life, that piece that gets laid down before the rest of the building gets constructed. But now we see it as like the capstone on our adult lives. It's that piece that you put on the end after you have everything else set in place. So that means you have to have your job set in place, your finances, maybe you've even bought a house. And it just takes longer then to be ready to meet our cultural ideas around what marriage should look like today than it did in the past.
Talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin from UW-Madison, looking at the economy, finances, and our relationship milestones. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Compare yourself to, say, your parents or grandparents' generation. Did you get married later? Why do you think that is? Are the costs leading you to delay doing something? Dating, finding someone, buying that engagement ring, buying that big fancy wedding, or did you economize on that? And hey, how about the cost of having kids? Have you considered that and maybe put off having kids in your own life? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, let's talk about the cost of having kids and childcare and how that's affecting people's decisions. What do we know?
So we certainly know that's a cost that's risen a lot. Our childcare market, basically in Wisconsin, but in the country as a whole, it really doesn't work. So there's really high demand, not enough supply, really low wages, and the costs are too high. So it sort of doesn't work for anybody. And that certainly can affect the decisions that some people make. But it can also, rather than affecting people's decisions about having children, it can affect the decisions people make about whether or not partners work part-time, work split shift. So it can affect family life in a lot of different ways. I think we, you know, can connect the decisions people make around having kids back to those larger conversations we were having earlier about feeling like there's instability in the world, feeling like you want to have your feet firmly under you before you get started having children. So all of those larger factors around finances can affect some of the decisions people make too. And for those people who want to wait until after they're married to have kids, as the age when people get married gets older, the age at which people have children then gets older, and the sort of time frame in which you can have kids before it becomes harder to do so can get smaller and smaller.
Yeah, in a way, when I think back, Sarah, there's always some kind of instability in the world if you look back through history, and there's always some kind of uncertainty about our life stages, our careers. Are these changes being driven by economic changes, or are these cultural changes in the way we think of these institutions?
You're totally right. There's always been, you know, different sources of instability on a global level and a local level, but our ideas around what family life needs to look like have changed a lot. And so I think that cultural piece that you pointed to is really important. in family sociology, we talk about this idea of deinstitutionalization, which is this huge word. And basically it means marriage is just less of a guiding institution in our society than it used to be. In family life, there are fewer and less constraining social roles and social rules, like all wives must do this or all fathers do that. And what that can mean is there's a lot more freedom. There's a lot less stigma around having your family look or function differently than someone else's family. But it also means that life is harder to navigate because you have to figure it out yourself. There's not just the way that everybody does things. And so we've seen those really big changes in our cultural ideas and ideals around family life.
Talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin, professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison, looking at the financial costs involved in our romantic relationships, the role that economics play in when and how we date, get married, have kids, and hoping you'll put a face on it, or at least a voice on it, at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share your experiences, did you put off getting married maybe longer than, say, your parents' generation did? What drove that? Did you hold off on scheduling that wedding till you could afford something bigger? Did the costs of childcare weigh into your decision of when and whether even to have kids? Join in with your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or were you like me and you economized and you got a $30 wedding ring and did in fact get married in your mother-in-law's living room? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Sarah Halpern-Meekin, professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. She's with us today to look at the role money plays in our love lives, from dating to marriage, even having kids. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What role has money or finances played in your romantic life, or lack of same at some stages? Have finances influenced your decisions on when to get engaged or married or have kids? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I have what I think is a funny story to tell. In my, you know, when I went to college, we stayed up late at night talking about philosophical things like marriage and family and money and careers and stuff. Well, I eventually went into a low-income ministry where I worked with poor people, and I met a really nice lady that I really liked, and I asked her to marry me. And she goes, no, I won't marry you. You don't have anything. I says, well, neither do you. And so we eventually didn't get married, but we stayed friends. But 30 years later, I found out neither one of us married, and we still don't have anything.
Jeff, thanks for the call. You know, Sarah, I think that question of, am I marrying a spouse who's going to make enough money on one side or the other, an eternal question and probably an issue these days, too.
Yeah, you know, what Jeff was speaking to, right, is this idea that what's okay in a dating partner might not be okay in a spouse. And so we see that people will do things like starting to cohabit together so that they can shore up their finances. But then we'll also see cohabitors saying they're putting off marriage because they're not financially ready for it. And what's so interesting there, right, is those people are already living together. So they're living together the same way they would be if they were married. But it's this cultural idea we have around what your relationship, what your finances should be like to make them marriage worthy. And when that bar is hard to reach, it can mean that people avoid taking those steps either short term or, like Jeff was saying, for the long term.
Jeff, thanks for being willing to share your story at 800-642-1234. You could join in and share your story of how you hit those milestones, whether money was a factor in who you dated, when you married, if you married, whether or not you had kids. Join in at 800-642-1234. Sarah, what are some of the biggest questions on your mind when it comes to these relationship milestones? As we have this post-COVID economy, what are some of the big unanswered things for you right now?
I think there's just a lot of really interesting trends that we're seeing. You know, as I was saying, we're seeing more people do family life in their own way, right? It's not just dictated by, you know, this is the one way to live a family life. And so we're seeing more variation in what that looks like. We're seeing more unmarried couples buy houses together. So about 1 in 10 home buyers recently were unmarried couples. That's a really serious form of financial and long-term commitment, right? You know, you have a 30-year mortgage. That's a long-term commitment to each other. We see more people having children together outside of marriage. So about 4 out of 10 births today are to unmarried people. That again is going to be a lifelong connection you have with this other person. So you can get divorced, but that's always going to be your kid's other parent. And so one of the things that we're interested in is understanding more about how people navigate and create family life when they have to figure it all out themselves, because we don't have those strict norms telling us this is how you have to be a family.
And something you just mentioned reminded me of something you said earlier, and this is something I've seen in my own extended family where people living together break up, keep living together because they can't afford to maintain two separate households. Again, I've seen this in my own extended family. Is that something we're seeing at large?
So we certainly hear those anecdotes. I think especially we'll hear it like in New York City, other really expensive cities where it's not possible to even find an apartment, you know, let alone live separately, that finances do drive these decisions. I know in some of my own research that we've seen that when people are living together and they do break up, they're more likely to get back together. So not moving out with each other sort of puts you in proximity, makes it more likely you're going to fall back into bed together at the very least, even if not, you know, reunite long term. And so these financial decisions and circumstances really do shape the trajectories of relationships. And, you know, we can also talk about how they shape the stressors that relationships are under, because that's another component of what goes into this this mix of finances influencing relationships.
Let's go back to our callers now. Kara is with us in Waukesha. Kara, hi. Are you there, Kara?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi. Yeah,
go ahead. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, so I kind of have something to add to it. I've got a partner that I've been living with for almost 10 years now, and we personally have made the decision not to get married simply for the fact that he had a harder time, you know, growing up, didn't have the best credit score, you know, in his young adult life, whereas I did have those resources available to me. So, you know, I actually went out, bought a house. We lived together under my mortgage, but we get a lot of pressure from the outside about, hey, you guys have been together. Why aren't you married yet? You know, when are you going to have kids, when it's really us making the decisions for ourselves financially not to get married because it's setting us up for success due to just one person having a better credit score than the other at this point.
And Kara, thank you for calling in and sharing that. Do you explain that to, you know, the family member who says, hey, when are you getting married? Or do you just kind of give them a quick, short answer, a none of your business kind of deal?
Pretty conservative Christian background. So I guess, you know, living out of wedlock is not something that's smiled upon from my immediate family, whereas from his family, he comes from a Latin American background, so they're much more comfortable with us living together under out of wedlock, whereas my family is, it's a sensitive subject that comes up at holidays a lot.
Kara, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Sarah, there's that we're doing our family the way we want to, yet also facing, at least from one side of the family, some social pressure.
Yeah, and that really speaks to the way that we've seen a relatively rapid cultural change around this. And so you still have people who are more committed to those old cultural norms and people who are, you know, have moved on from being guided by those cultural norms. What Kara speaks to, right, is this is this issue around what does it mean for our finances to be united? And so, you know, when people get married, their credit scores do remain separate. So you don't take on your spouse's bad credit. But if you go to make purchases together and you're both putting your names on that car loan application or that mortgage application, then both of your credit scores are taken into account. So that's one of those times where joining finances can matter. There are other circumstances where getting married can be financially beneficial. So it can affect your access to your spouse's health insurance that they might have through an employer. It can be beneficial tax-wise for some couples. It can also be costly tax-wise for other couples, depending on what your earnings are like. And so there are lots of those individual decisions that couples need to make in considering how they're going to be together as a couple long-term and what that might mean for whether they come out ahead or face more financial struggles because of it.
Kara, thanks for that call. And Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Halpern-Meekin is the Vaughn Baskin Professor of Women, Family, and Community and a Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison's School of Human Ecology. We listened back to our conversation with her about the ways finances and the economy can affect our romantic relationships and key relationship milestones. You can still let us know about your experience. How has money affected your relationships? What about your decision to get married, move in with someone, have kids? Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org to share your story. Coming up after the news, homelessness is on the rise in communities around the country. We'll take a look at how we got here and check out some solutions, some ways to reverse that trend. You can follow conversations like these all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org. You could stream live. You can check out archives maybe that you missed or want to take a second listen to. Or you can share those conversations with friends, family, maybe even enemies. You can also do all of those things with the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get advice about what to do if we feel like our concerns aren't being taken seriously at the doctor's office. Now, the Wall Street Journal recently reported that homelessness in the United States is up 11% from last year. That's the biggest year-over-year increase the country has seen since the government started tracking these numbers back in 2007. And it's not just a story about one or two large urban areas. Cities and rural communities around the country have seen a rise in their homeless populations. If so many communities are seeing problems with homelessness, are there solutions that could work across the country? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is it tough to find affordable housing where you live? Have you or your family been impacted by evictions? Have you been homeless for part of your life at some point? If you got out of that, what helped? What solutions you'd like to see locally at the state or national level? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mary Beth Shin is a professor in the Department of Human and Organizational Development at Vanderbilt University, where her research focuses on ways to prevent and end homelessness. Beth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
What do you think is behind what looks like a significant jump in homelessness as reported by the Wall Street Journal?
The increase in the prices of housing is the central cause.
How much does that drive homelessness? I know people point toward a lot of different factors, addiction or problems in particular communities. Is it that simple, a pretty direct correlation between what it costs to find housing and homelessness?
That's certainly a pretty direct correlation between housing costs and rates of homelessness. the particular people who become homeless may have other vulnerabilities, such as mental illnesses or substance abuse, but rates of homelessness are largely driven by the cost of housing.
Let's talk about the different kinds of homelessness we might see, the different groups who are affected by it. We might see, you know, a person on the street and think, okay, that's the whole story about homelessness. What do we know about the different stories and the different kinds of people who end up without housing?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe a third of the people who end up without housing do so as part of families. And a surprising fact is that the age at which you are most likely to be found in a homeless shelter in the United States is infancy. Little kids cost a lot of money. I mean, babies are a joy, they're a blessing, but they're also expensive. And homelessness rates stay high in the preschool years when parents have high costs for childcare. They drop when children get to public school age and childcare expenses drop. So that's about a third of it. About two-thirds is adults. We often call them single adults, though some of those folks are parents of minor children. And some of them have partners that and other people that they want to live with, but our shelters don't accommodate them. And then we have, probably an important group to talk about is military veterans. And they're important because we have succeeded in cutting homelessness by more than half among military veterans. And so that points to the solutions that we can use to reduce homelessness for everybody.
We'll start digging into the solutions in just a minute. But one other thing I wanted to ask first is we might think of homelessness as someone who year-round is living without housing. But it could be someone is homeless for a week here, a few days there. What do we know about how chronic homelessness is for different groups of people?
That's an important question because most people pass through homelessness and out the other side. Most people who become homeless are homeless fairly briefly. But people who have trouble extricating themselves from homelessness mount up so that if you look on a single day, you'll find more people who are homeless for a long period of time. But if you look over the course of a year or longer, you'll find many more people, most of whom were homeless fairly briefly. In fact, back in 1990, there was a telephone survey of people living in conventional dwellings, nobody who was homeless, nobody who was in prison, nobody in a mental hospital. And the researchers asked, has there ever been a time in your life when you've been homeless? And 14% of people said yes. And so then there were follow-up questions to say, well, were you literally homeless? Were you on the streets or in a shelter or in a public place? And 7% of the people said yes. The rest of them had considered themselves homeless while they were doubled up with other people because they couldn't afford a place of their own. So a lot of people experience homelessness at some point in their lives. Most people pass through that.
Talking to Mary Beth Shin from Vanderbilt University. She researches prevention and solutions for homelessness. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Beth, let's turn to solutions now. And you mentioned veteran homelessness as, at least in part, a success story. What kind of things do we see there that worked?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's been a full court press to try to reduce veteran homelessness. So one important program is the HUD-VASH program. That's supportive housing for veterans that is partly funded by HUD. HUD provides the housing and partly funded by the VA, and they provide the supportive services. And that's been very successful, particularly for folks who have disabilities. Then there are prevention programs. So every vet who goes into a VA hospital for any kind of medical care gets asked once a year about whether they're currently homeless or whether they are at risk of homelessness, whether they're worried about losing their housing, and they can get preventive services. And then there are services to help people get back on their feet, more temporary kinds of housing subsidies. Then mayors have been challenged to end homelessness among veterans in their communities. And so there are these layers of support and resources that have been focused on veterans, and it works. If we gave the same kinds of levels of support to everybody, we could reduce homelessness for everyone else as well.
You've done research trying different solutions for homelessness. Again, the homelessness may look different depending on who we're talking about. Let's start with those families with young children you mentioned earlier. What interventions seem to work the best to keep them in housing, out of shelters?
Mm-hmm. Well, with colleagues at Apt Associates, we did a big study where we randomized over 2,200 families that we recruited across the country in 12 different sites to different housing and service interventions to answer that question. And what we found was that giving families access to ongoing housing subsidies, typically in the form of something called a housing choice voucher that holds your housing expenses to 30% of the household income, both reduces homelessness and has radiating benefits for other aspects of family life. So families who had access to those housing vouchers had lower levels of psychological distress, and they reduced substance abuse, they reduced domestic violence. Things that can sometimes cause homelessness were reduced when families had access to housing that they could afford. Kids' behavior problems went down, their school attendance went up, food security for families was better, there were fewer separations of parents from children, fewer placements in foster care. So these enormous radiating benefits simply from giving families housing that they could afford without any additional specialized services. So families were free to use whatever services were in their community, but there was nothing special given to them. So for families, I think we know the answer. And other studies have found that those same housing vouchers prevent homelessness among families who might otherwise be at risk.
And how about the individual adults, the single adults who are unhoused? Do we know what kind of interventions seem to work best for them?
We know most about the folks with the most problems, folks with serious mental illnesses and substance abuse disorders. And we know more about them because we have federal institutes that are willing to do research on those folks. And they're the best solution is something called the Pathways to Housing model. It's a version of Housing First, but the label Housing First at this point takes in a multitude of different kinds of programs. This is a program that gives people access to housing with private landlords directly from the street without any prerequisites for sobriety or participation in treatment, but with wraparound services. Now, families didn't need those same services that people with serious mental illnesses or substance problems have, but it's important that those services be voluntary. So those could be mental health services and substance services, but also vocational services, helping people to get a job, and recreational services so that people with serious disabilities aren't lonely when they get into housing. And that kind of a program is really successful with about 85% of folks, even with these more serious problems. The group we know least about is adults that don't have serious mental illnesses or substance problems. And we know least about them because we've done the least research about them.
One thing I wanted to key in on there, you mentioned a couple times substance abuse and mental illness. And I think it's a common thought that I have thought in the past is that, okay, substance abuse and mental health problems are a cause of homelessness, which may be true, but I've seen more arguments that homelessness may exacerbate or even cause substance abuse problems, exacerbate mental health problems. By finding a housing solution, we might be actually tackling those other problems as well. Is there something to that?
There's definitely something to that, and it can go both ways. Mm-hmm. So stress and homelessness is certainly stressful, can exacerbate mental health problems, and it can lead people to hit the bottle. Some people don't hit the bottle until after they hit the street. Other people have problems before they enter homelessness. But, you know, I'll tell you a secret. I'm a university professor. You probably don't know this, but a lot of university students have substance problems, too. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever says they became college students because of their substance problems, right? So we're too ready to attribute homelessness to whatever problems people may have. It is certainly the case that substance abuse can be severe enough to lead to homelessness. And it's certainly the case that folks with serious mental illnesses are at higher risk. But why is that? Why should the penalty for mental illness be homelessness? The reason is that disability benefits for people with serious mental illnesses are too low for folks to afford housing. So when the mental hospitals closed, people moved out into cheap housing. They moved out into board and care homes in California and to single room occupancy hotels in New York. And it was when those cheap forms of housing disappeared that people moved to the streets. So mental illness and substance abuse certainly can cause homelessness. People who are experiencing homelessness have higher levels of those problems than other people. But giving people appropriate housing can reduce those problems, particularly if it's severe psychological distress. You're not going to cure a schizophrenic disorder with housing, but you can certainly reduce depressive symptoms with housing.
We're talking to Mary Beth Shin from Vanderbilt University about rising rates of homelessness around the country and how we can fix it. Maybe at the national level, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have rising rates of homelessness affected your community? Are there programs you think work, ones you've heard of elsewhere maybe that you'd like to see tried in Wisconsin? Do you have a question for our guest about preventing or ending homelessness? Do you have an experience to share maybe from your own life or that of a loved one? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Mary Beth Shin, professor in the Department of Human and Organizational Development at Vanderbilt University, talking about ways to prevent and end homelessness. As the country sees a record increase in the unhoused population, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have rising costs of living been a concern for you or your family? What resources would you like to see made available to help people stay housed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Beth, I want to get to the point that you brought up right at the outset there. No surprise to people, housing costs are going up in many, many places around the country. Hard to find affordable housing. It seems like that is such a big problem. Are there things that could actually address that to prevent homelessness, given that it's apparently just an economic condition we live with now?
Well, it really requires, I think, some government intervention. Developers know how to put together housing subsidies to create housing for people who are close to the median income, close to the average income in their community. So they can build housing that they call affordable for people who are at 80% of area median income. But it's very hard for developers to create housing and maintain it in a way that's affordable to people who are at 30% of area median income. And different surveys of folks experiencing homelessness say they're down around, on average, 15% of area median income. So deep subsidies are necessary, and that's going to have to come from the public sector.
Let's bring on a caller now. Milo is with us in Milwaukee. Milo, hello.
Hey, I had a question. So I'm from Milwaukee, and here we have sky-high prices in regard to housing. I don't think that's news. What can we do as citizens to help bring down prices? Do we vote for politicians that want to regulate business or what?
Milo, thanks for the call. Looking a little more upstream there, Beth, did you have thoughts for Milo?
Uh-huh. Well, there are a couple of things that you can do as citizens and with your vote. One is to ask your city government and your state government and your federal officials to put more money into affordable housing. And another is to look at zoning requirements in your community, because zoning requirements often create bottlenecks for building housing. They often prohibit less expensive forms of housing. They often require big lots or single family housing, where you could put in multifamily housing that could be constructed more cheaply. So those are two things that you can do.
Thanks for that call, Milo, at 800-642-1234. Laura joins us now from Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Hi. I've got a friend who's divorced, and she's an educated woman. Her income is not really great. Her kids are grown up, and she simply can't afford a place to live. She recently left a friend's home, and she basically doesn't have any place where she can afford to live.
Laura, thanks. Best to your friend. Beth, not an uncommon story, I'm guessing.
Not uncommon at all. And people in that situation often, like your friend, double up with someone else. They move in with someone else for a while. That situation often breaks down, and they may become what we call literally homeless. They may go to a shelter or the streets. But there are just too many Americans who can't afford the cost of housing.
Laura, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mary Beth Shin from Vanderbilt University, looking at a jump in homelessness numbers in the United States, some of the causes and possible solutions for homelessness. Are there things you could see? Again, this is a local problem in so many communities, Beth, but are there things that the federal government could be doing to help help all the communities that are dealing with this jump in homelessness?
Mm-hmm. Well, the two things, I guess, that the federal government could do would be a large increase in the Housing Choice Voucher Program. That's the program that provides housing subsidies that hold your housing costs to 30% of your income. And only about one in four households that's eligible by reason of income gets those, because there just aren't enough to go around. So there is an increase in housing vouchers in the Build Back Better program that did not pass the Congress. We really need a big increase there. And then we also need the federal government to subsidize the construction of low-income housing. And we have programs there, the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit, that also need to be expanded to create more housing. It depends a little bit from community to community. I mean, in some communities, there is housing available, but it's simply not affordable. And in other communities, there's just no housing available. And so the solution for a particular community depends a little bit on that balance. But everywhere, we're seeing problems that people simply can't afford housing, whether it's there or whether it needs to be constructed.
Are there common myths or stereotypes or misconceptions about homelessness that you run into when you talk to the public about the issue?
Mm-hmm. A lot of people think that homelessness is people's fault, that it really has to do with individual frailties of various sorts. You know, in my classes, I sometimes ask students two questions. And I put write them on slips of paper so they don't know that other people have different questions. And one question is, why do some people become homeless? And the other question is, why do so many people become homeless? And answers to the why do some people become homeless question has to do with, you know, mental illness and substance abuse and domestic violence. And those are all vulnerability factors. They are important. And the answers to the question about why do so many people become homeless tend to be about housing costs and about rental vacancy rates and things like that, and also structural issues, you know, racism that creates more homelessness in minority communities. And both of those answers are right, but the rates of homelessness are really driven by those structural factors. They're driven by the cost of housing, they're driven by racial discrimination, they're driven by incarceration rates, and then who's vulnerable when there isn't enough housing to go around is sometimes driven by those individual factors. And I think people confuse those. And they like to say, oh, well, that person is homeless because of something he did or because of who he is, rather than because we simply don't have enough housing to go around and he's the one who lost out.
Beth, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mary Beth Shin is a professor in the Department of Human and Organizational Development at Vanderbilt University, where her research focuses on ways to prevent and end homelessness. Talking to her about big picture solutions to homelessness as communities around the country report increasing rates of homelessness. Tomorrow on the Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, find out what makes a great livable rural community. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. It's sunflower season here in Wisconsin and in many places around the world. And there's been a growing trend of sunflower farmers opening their fields up to the public for great views, maybe some good pictures. But if you're interested in touring your local sunflower field, maybe just assume there's a simple rule to follow. Keep your clothes on. As reported by the BBC, Stoke Fruit Farm on England's Hayling Island posted this month on Facebook, "Reminder to all, we're a family area. Please keep your clothes on in the sunflowers. We're having an increase of reports of naked photography taking place. This must not happen during our public sessions, please." Apparently, there's a social media trend with people posing nude with strategically placed sunflowers. Now, me, I'm a big fan of agritourism. I've done a lot of it here in Wisconsin, you know, picking berries, apples, pumpkins, the corn maze, dinner at a pizza farm. In every case, I've managed to stay fully clothed. I plan to continue that practice. Bringing you the naked truth, this is Central Time.